We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So last week, Maria did her election analysis, and Job, you had done yours the week before, and sure enough, the beginning of this week, we had a local election that apparently had a fairly good turnout, and we know some of the results.
Yeah, we do. Let's just dive right in there. For the federal races, the U.S. House of Representatives, the local reps, Democratic incumbents all did very well. Susan Del Benet, she easily led her Republican challenger. Premila Jayapal took 80% of the vote in District 7. She's going to face Republican Craig Keller. District 9, Adam Smith easily leads Republican Doug Baszler going into the November election. And then in District 10, which is Thurston County, including Olympia, that's the district that Denny Heck is retiring from. And there were 19 candidates in that race. The leader in that race is Democrat Marilyn Strickland with 21% of the vote. It appears she's going to be facing off against another Democratic challenger in November, and that's probably going to be Beth Doglio, who has 15% of the vote as of last night. And I don't expect that will change.
So that's Marilyn Strickland, who is the former president of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yes.
That's correct. And before that, she was the mayor of Tacoma. So she has roots in the 10th district. But she also has a lot of valuable business connections that helped her with fundraising. And she has to be considered the favorite going into November.
Yeah, particularly for her name recognition. But we'll see. I mean, there were 19 candidates in that race, so it's going to be pretty difficult at this point to tell who the absolute favorite is going to be, because the vote was very widely spread between several different Democratic candidates. So we'll see how those two match up as we get closer to November.
And Beth Doglio from the state legislature has a fair amount of name recognition herself in that district. So,
So that could be close.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. So then for the state races, for the governor's race, in a race that had the most candidates on the ballot, 36 separate candidates, of course, Jay Inslee led with a very comfortable 50% of the vote. And his challenger will be a Republican, but happily it won't be Tim Iman. It will be Lauren Culp. And it was very nice for me, at least, to see that Tim Iman only garnered less than half the number of votes that Lauren Culp did. But I expect Jay Inslee will probably prevail in November.
Yeah. Lauren Culp is the police chief of Republic, which is the county seat of Ferry County out in northeastern Washington. And he basically had the backing of the gun fetish lobby. That is his focus going into November. He's also been critical of Inslee's handling of the pandemic. You know, no, we didn't need to have those restrictions, freedom, no masks, et cetera. So, he's definitely from the, non-reality based, segment of the Republican Party.
Yes.
Actually, I think it's the vast majority of the Republican Party at this point, but, so I don't think he's going to pose a serious challenge to Inslee at all.
Yeah, come November. The race for lieutenant governor also had 11 candidates. But, of course, the two outstanding ones that we talked about made the cut this time around. Democrat Denny Heck led with just 26% of the vote. He's going to face off against Mark Elias, who had around 17% of the vote in November. And we'll see whether that majority flips or whether Denny Heck is a shoe-in for lieutenant governor.
I think that could be a very close race. You know, Denny Heck has name recognition, which on a crowded ballot always helps. But, you know, when the two of them actually, face off against each other. And, you know, the problem with down ticket, races like that is how many people are actually paying attention, especially in a year with a critical presidential race. How many people are going to be paying attention to the race for lieutenant governor? but it could be an important race and it could be an important role, especially if Joe Biden wins the presidency and, you know, Jay Inslee, I'm sure, will be lobbying for a cabinet position that would put the lieutenant governor in line to become at least the interim governor. So it's an important race and needs to have more attention than it will probably get.
Yeah, it's also one place a person who is thinking of running for governor in the future can get a little bit of training and get his name out there in front of the voters. So it will be an important race this year. Now, the race for Secretary of State, Republican Kim Wyman took over 51% of the vote. She's the incumbent and has done a pretty good job with mail-in voting here in the state of Washington. But Democrat Gail Tarleton had a respectable 43%. So this could be close in November if Gail Tarleton ramps up her campaign some more.
Yeah. And you know, Wyman has gotten some criticism for not embracing more reforms to make it easier for people to vote. She resisted the same-day voting that was done by initiative a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. But she has not gone the route of so many of her Republican Secretary of State colleagues of trying to suppress the vote and, you know, trying to purge voter rolls and all the rest of that nonsense. So she gets credit for that, I suppose. And she does have name recognition because she's been there for 8 years. So we'll see if Tarleton can make inroads on that.
Yeah. Now for state treasurer, Mike Pelliciotti, the Democrat in the race, had a slim 53% majority over Republican Duane Davidson's 47%. So this race also could be pretty close in November.
Yeah. And Davidson is the incumbent there.
Yeah. And then state auditor, Democrat incumbent Pat McCarthy had 47% over Republican Chris Labus 42% and rival Democrat Joshua Carey's 11%. So I think Pat McCarthy is pretty well set up to win in November. For Attorney General, the Democratic incumbent Bob Ferguson won 55% of the vote over three Republican challengers. He's going to face off against Matt Larkin in November. But I'm guessing he will also prevail pretty easily. For Commissioner of Public Lands, Democrat Hillary Franz, again, had a comfortable 51% over multiple Republican challengers. She'll face off against Republican Sue Kuehl Peterson in November. For the Superintendent of Public Instruction, incumbent Chris Reichdahl led with 40% of the vote over five other candidates. His challenger in November will be Maya Espinoza, and that one could turn out, I don't know, could turn out to be close, since Reichdahl didn't win 50%, even though he is the incumbent.
Yeah, and generally under 50% of the vote, and especially when you get around 40% of the vote, even in a crowded race, that's when incumbents are considered vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So, but again, it's a kind of race that, aside from people who care a lot about education policy and schools, not that many people pay attention to that race. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out in November. Especially with a woman of color running against him, that could be a close race.
It could be, yeah. For insurance commissioner, incumbent Mike Kreidler took 59% of the vote, a very comfortable majority against his Republican challenger, Chirayu Avinash Patel, who had 28%. They'll face off again in November since there was a third candidate in that race. Now for the Washington State Legislature, now this year there was a slate of candidates that represent issues of income inequality, increased services for communities of color, and police reform. So it's really useful to kind of look at how those candidates did here in the Puget Sound region. In District 11, House position one, that's much of southeast Seattle from Beacon Hill to Georgetown and parts of Kent and Renton. Activist Democrat David Hackney took 43% of the vote and he led that race. He's going to face off against incumbent mainstream Democrat Zach Hudgens in November. And Hudgens is very vulnerable here. I think Hackney could well unseat him.
Yeah, and you know, Hudgens has done a reasonably good job over the years as a Democratic, you know, mainstream liberal Democrat, but he doesn't really represent the district. He's a white guy, and it's a majority minority district.
He's also pretty strongly supported by corporate money as well.
Yeah, so it'll be a very competitive race, and we'll see how it shakes out.
Yeah. Now, District 30, that's the Federal Way area. In House Position 1, Democrat Jamila Taylor won 43% of the vote. Her closest challenger, Republican Martin Moore, took 27% of the vote. So that's some very good news. Jamila Taylor is seen as the progressive candidate in that race. In District 32, House Position 1, that's the Linwood Edmonds Shoreline area, Democrat incumbent Cindy Ryu, who is backed by a host of insurance companies and other corporate interests, had an overwhelming lead of 64%. Her challenger will be progressive Democrat Shirley Sutton, who took 24%. She's got a tough hill to climb to win in November, even though I think she's the better candidate in that race.
Yeah, and she's on Linwood City Council, so she does have some name recognition in that district, but it didn't really help a whole lot this past week.
Yeah. Now, in that same district for House Position 2, the former Gates Foundation employee, Democrat Lauren Davis, took an overwhelming 74% of the vote. Now, I endorsed Gray Peterson in that race. He only took 9% and didn't make it through to the final. That challenger in the final will be Tamara Smolanich, who took 16% running as a nonpartisan candidate. So I think in that district, Lauren Davis looks like a shoe-in for that position in November.
Unfortunately, I think that's correct.
Yeah. Now, in District 36, that's Belltown, Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. That's my district. House Position 2 is the contested race. There, three Democrats ran for this seat. Liz Berry won just under 50% of the vote, but her main challenger, Sarah Reinvel, who's the managing assistant attorney general in Bob Ferguson's office, won 43% of the vote. They're both good candidates, and this race could narrow and be pretty close in November. And I'm going to be looking again at this race because it is my district and evaluating these two candidates more closely in October because they both look like good candidates, and it's a little difficult right now to tell them apart. So,
And it's probably the most competitive race within the city of Seattle for the state legislature this year.
I think so.
And it'll be very interesting.
Yeah, and it's an overwhelmingly white and affluent district, and it'll be very, very interesting because both of these candidates are running as sort of self-described progressive candidates. So I would like to take a closer look at them and see, is one masquerading as progressive, and is there one that's
or
better
both.
Than the other? Yeah, that's a possibility too. Now, in District 37, that's downtown Seattle, Capitol Hill, and southeast Seattle, and all the way down to Renton,
that's my district.
Yes, that is your district. The Democratic incumbent, Sharon Tamiko Santos, won 77% for House Position 1, so she looks like she'll be a shoo-in. She'll run against Democrat John Stafford in November. Now, in the Position 2 race, that was the more contested race. In a field of seven candidates, former Seattle City Councilman...
And an open seat also. Eric Pettigrew is retiring.
Oh, yeah. Former Seattle City Council member Kirsten Harris-Talley took a very well-deserved 51% of the vote. Her challenger will be Chikundi Salisbury, who took 23% of the vote. So it looks like Kirsten Harris-Talley may also be a shoo-in in November.
Yeah, she ran a very strong race. She was an interim city council member as a representative of Seattle People's Party a couple of years ago during the head tax fight, and really acquitted herself quite well and made a lot of friends and raised a lot of money for this race. Chikundi Salisbury got a lot of unexpected visibility when his brother became a prominent live streamer of the protests, Omari Salisbury. Chikundi has also got a lot of roots in the community. He's also African American. He's an immigrant. And they're both very good candidates. So we'll see, if that develops at all before November. But, Kirsten looks like she'll be in the state legislature next year.
Yeah. And then the final race I want to look at is, District 43, Position 2. That's the U District, Wallingford, Fremont, Finney Ridge, and South Green Lake. And I think
you don't want to cover Frank Chop?
Well, that's what I'm going to talk about. This is, I think this is Mike's district.
It includes
the university district. Former House Speaker Frank Chop had just under 53% of the vote. His challenger is progressive community organizer Sheree Lascelles, who took about 29% of the vote. Again, that's a really respectable showing in this race, but she's going to have a very steep climb to overcome Chop's
familiarity. Sheree identifies as non-binary, so Sheree is they. Yeah.
Yes, sorry. They'll have a very steep climb to overcome Chop's name familiarity and in this district. But 29% of the vote is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, it's a much more progressive district than Chop has represented it as over the years. And so this was the district whose race launched Sharma Sawant's career back in 2012 also. So it has a history of people trying to take on Chop, and they're generally not successful, but they have they can pressure him to be more representative of the district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that wraps up my coverage of the race. Was there any other candidates you wanted to look at, Joff?
No, that pretty much was the main ones on the ballot. There were no initiatives this time. And we'll have all of those races plus initiatives plus the presidential race. No U.S. Senate races in Washington State this year. So that's what will be on the ballot come November.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, assuming we have an election in November, of course.
Yes, we will have an election.
Well, Washington State will have an election. Whether the rest of the country is synchronized with that is another question. But we'll cover that in coming weeks.
Yes, we will.
All right. Let's move on to City Council, which was very busy this week with talking about funding or lack thereof for SPD.
Yeah. The City Council voted on about 24 amendments to the Seattle Police Department's budget for the rest of 2020 in an effort to find meaningful cuts in the SPD budget. Teresa Mosqueda took 13 amendments that had garnered the most support from the City Council members and put them together into a consent package that the council could then vote on as a group. Those amendments amounted to a cut of 85 positions in the police department, and that included 32 recruits, not patrol officers, all 4 mounted patrol officers, 5 public outreach officers, or in other words, public relations officers, 4 public affairs officers, the sworn officers who talk to the media, which didn't completely cut that department, as Mayor Durkin and Chief Best said, because there are civilian personnel in that department that talk to the press as well. And it also cuts the five school resource officers, 2 harbor patrol officers, 2 SWAT team members, 1 officer assigned to the quote unquote Homeland Security Unit, which actually provides security at special events like bumper shoot and sports games. And then also there was an amendment in there to not spend money to fill positions that fall vacant in the police department. They expect about 30 positions to fall vacant this year. Now, it also included 3 other amendments. It included Dan Strauss's proposal to hold funding for the SPD starting on September 30th, 2020, until the Seattle Police Department or the mayor identifies which of the units within the police department can be staffed by civilians and or move to other departments within the city. There was another amendment that Dan Strauss and Lisa Herbold co-sponsored. It was a requirement that funding for the Seattle Police Department be held until the SPD or the mayor submits financial reports every 2 weeks that include amounts spent on personnel contracts, consulting, training, travel, weapons purchases, equipment purchases, legal fees, spent on lawsuits against the department and individual officers and any federal grants received by the SPD. And then finally, there was another amendment to spend $50,000 on studying what it would take to get Councilmember Andrew Lewis's proposed civilian 911 response system up and running. So that was the consent package, and the council passed those amendments. And then the council considered the other amendments on a one-by-one basis and voted to pass the following amendments. They passed two amendments that will, one, cut all 14 Seattle Police Department officers in the navigation team, and two, cut all funding from the Human Services and Finance and Administrative Services departments effective for the navigation team, effectively ending all functions of the navigation team, except for the funding for the Parks Department to provide trash pickup. That's all that remains of the navigation team in this budget. This passed on a close 5-4 vote, with Alex Peterson, Deborah Juarez, Dan Strauss, and Andrew Lewis voting against it. And I think the reason why, Alex Peterson and Deborah Juarez voted against it, I think, because they're fine with the sweeps. Dan Strauss and Andrew Lewis voted against it, I think, because they wanted more services for homeless people, and they thought perhaps leaving funding for human services from the Human Services and Finance and Administration Services Department would allow that. But there is other money in the budget.
I would also add that they represent that. District 6 and 6 and 7, which are probably the two districts that have the most pressure against homeless encampments.
District 6 is Ballard, and that's the, you know, Safe Seattle neighborhood group is strongest there. That's Dan Strauss's district, and then Andrew Lewis's District 7, which is, you know, predominantly
Magnolia in downtown.
Magnolia, downtown, Queen Anne, Belltown area, and has the downtown business community within it. Yeah. Now, there were two other, but those two amendments passed. It was a close vote, but they did pass. So bye-bye navigation team, as long as Mayor Durkin and Chief Best decide to follow the guidelines in this budget.
which is an open question. But if they do, it's tremendously good news for homeless service providers, because the navigation teams have been enormously counterproductive in terms of addressing the homeless issue in Seattle.
Disruptive for other service providers who say, you know, they try to offer services to people in encampments. They go back a couple of days later and the encampment's gone. And so how do they find those people they were trying to build a relationship with when the city keeps sweeping them from place to place? So this is very good news. Now, there were two other amendments, too, that the council voted on to provide funding for community public safety options. One was $4 million to fund community safety hubs through a partnership with four organizations led by people of color. And those four organizations are Community Passageways, Urban Family Center, Southeast Safety Network Hub Boys and Girls Club, and the Alive and Free program of the YMCA. All four organizations work on youth violence prevention and alternatives to incarceration for youth. So the city council set aside $4 million for that. And then second amendment was $10 million for the Human Services Department to contract with a single nonprofit organization to award grants to other nonprofit groups within BIPOC communities to help with connecting adults to housing, food security, life counseling, financial counseling, and other basic needs. Previously, this $14 million was going to come from the city's rainy day fund, but these amendments were revised to borrow the money from an interfund loan taken from the construction and inspections fund, which would then be repaid next year through salary savings in the police department or through the jumpstart tax, instead of, you know, draining the rainy day fund. Now, Shama Sawant's amendment to another amendment that was passed by the city council was Shama Sawant's amendment to cap salaries in the Seattle Police Department. That was revised with help from Alex Peterson into two new amendments. The first amendment would cap the salaries for 13 non-union executives in the Seattle Police Department, so its top personnel, including Chief Best, the Chief Operating Officer, six assistant chiefs, and five directors. Their salaries will be capped at the lowest hourly rate in their pay tier through the end of 2020. This provision expires on the first day of next year because, of course, the new 2021 budget will govern then. This amendment passed by 6-3 with Peterson, Juarez, and Lewis voting no because they thought it might get challenged in court, because executives usually have an employment agreement with the city that specifies their pay rate. Now, the second amendment that governs salaries requires the SPD to issue monthly reports on employees who are on track to make more than $150,000 in 2020. This reporting requirement amendment passed unanimously. Finally, Sawant's two amendments to cut an additional $75 million in funding to the Seattle Police Department in order to bring this year's cuts to a full 50% of the Seattle Police Department budget didn't gain any traction with the other council members at all, who chose instead the incremental approach that I just described that isn't going to lead to meaningful cuts this year, but is expected to lead to a 41% cut next year, or about $170 million in the 2021 budget for the SPD. That is if Mayor Durkin and Chief Best agree to carry out these cuts. But, you know, Durkin and Best have been pretty adamant in saying that they're not going to carry out the city council's cuts. They've even recruited the city's labor standards department to give what I think is a ridiculously pessimistic estimate that seems to be saying that the city can never lay off sworn police officers without first laying off every other type of employee within the SPD, including new recruits of color, contractors, and civilian personnel. And we know that that's just not right, and it can't be right, because the Public Safety Civil Service Commission laws have wording that allows layoffs to occur out of order of seniority. The wording is there. It exists. And it provides for that eventuality, even if it's never been used for mass layoffs before. We know it has been used for individual layoffs, so there is some precedent for using it. But I just don't agree with the assessment that that the mayor and the chief of police got from the city's labor standards department, saying, oh, we don't think it can ever be used for mass layoffs.
And you had both council president Gonzalez and Teresa Mosqueda, council member, just eviscerating Durkin over what they say are misrepresentations of what the council wants to do. They've been very critical of Durkin's approach to this, and saying basically that Durkin and Best are putting out disinformation to try and sway the public, which I think is correct. They are doing that. It's an open question whether Durkin will cooperate with these amendments, but you know, the five to four vote means that unless a couple of council members, probably Strauss and Lewis, can be convinced to switch votes, that a veto would be upheld. And so I think we're likely to see that veto, and then it'll go back to council again. But I also wanted to point out that none of this would have been happening without the protests over the last couple months and the very explicit demands to cut 50% from SPD's budget. That has been a tremendous put a tremendous pressure on city council and on the city to get in line. And that activism, I think, is going to continue and should continue. that pressure is going to continue because most of the activists who've been marching this last week or so did not see these cuts as nearly adequate enough. They want to see more, and they should press for more. So we'll see what City Council responds.
And I think the tactic of visiting council members in their you know, at their homes, I think that was brilliant, actually.
Yes.
Scott, they've been, you know, widely reviled in the mainstream press here, but I think the tactic of marching every night and visiting each council member, one at a time at their homes on different nights, you know, I think that's been absolutely brilliant.
And the council members have generally handled that really well. They've come out, they've talked, they've been very, very approachable. Alex Peterson, when they marched to his home this past week, he marched with them, which I thought was kind of brilliant also, even though he's, you know, not voting for the cuts. But he did engage with them.
I thought that was Council Member Strauss who did that.
No, that was Council Member Peterson who did that this week.
Okay.
They did visit Strauss a week before last. And
He did that as well.
Yeah.
So Peterson had more lead time on how to handle the PR end of it.
I'll have to give real props to Lisa Herbold. She was the first council member to actually come out of her home after Deborah Juarez had kind of cowered in her home and refused to come out. Lisa Herbold came out and met with them. She was the first one to actually talk face to face with them. And after that, it kind of set the precedent for other council members to do the same.
Yeah, and they visited her again, and she came out and talked with them again this past week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and that makes sense. She's the chair of the Public Safety Committee, so really, she should be the one who is the expert on the SPD budget and should be guiding a lot of the talks over the SPD budget. So yeah, that was good, and she actually explained to the media this week, Herbold did, that the city council structured these amendments as budget provisos that would put a hold on any money saved through the cuts this year to the SPD instead of allocating that savings to other spending in the budget, which is why they're borrowing money to spend on community safety projects. Herbold was very clear about the fact that these are budget provisos. If the cuts don't actually happen, the money's not, there's no other shortfall in the budget, that then has to be plugged later. And Herbold is foreseeing that it's going to take time, probably, to implement, layoffs and implement the cuts if the mayor and Chief Best decide to do them at all. And if they don't decide to do them, then it's not going to put a big crater in the budget, because those funds are not allocated to be spent anywhere else yet. And I want to point out that Mayor Durkin has refused to spend money that the city council has already allocated, like in last year's budget process, to, for example, expand the law enforcement assisted diversion program and to provide mobile showers and hygiene services for homeless folks. Those are two items that Durkin has not spent. So she's notorious for not taking the guidance of the city council, who is supposed to hold the power of the purse, right? But they don't when the mayor doesn't follow the budget that they pass.
And this again, is a tactic that Durkin has borrowed from Donald Trump at the federal level. But so it's an open question whether anything the council passed that Durkin doesn't like is going to be implemented by the executive branch. That's a real problem, and it needs to be it needs to be talked about during her reelection next year.
Really does. It really does. And, you know, about the only way the council can sanction her is by a recall of the mayor. And so far, the city council, led this year by Lorena Gonzalez, has chosen instead to just gripe about the mayor and not to contemplate recalling her. Now, as for the budget, as Job said on Monday morning, the council may consider a couple more amendments this coming Monday, but then they're expected to vote the SPD budget out of committee on Monday morning. And then in the afternoon, they'll take a final vote on the full 2020 budget package, including the final SPD budget for the year. So that's the timeline.
Yeah. And that again is going to be a long day and a very interesting day. So
there could be more interesting amendments too.
Yes, the possibility of new amendments or amended amendments is still out there. So People want to follow this. It'll all be done over Zoom starting Monday morning, and then 2 o'clock is the final vote in the afternoon. So tune in, and there'll be a comment period, I think, in both sessions also.
Yeah, usually there's a comment period for the Monday morning meeting. People sign up at 8 a.m., so you'll want to do that.
And then the meeting itself starts at 9.
Mm-hmm.
Weren't there also developments this week regarding SPD, Seattle Police Department, and Seattle Public Schools?
Yes, there was SPD will no longer provide officers to Seattle Public Schools. That was I believe that was in one of the consent decree.
That was in the consent package of 13 amendments that were bundled together to cut all of the school resource officers.
Okay. All right. Okay. So we'll be finding out more about that this coming week, starting bright and early on Monday morning. Talk about Mayor Durkin and speaking of vetoes.
Yeah, Mayor Durkin's unwillingness to spend money that the city council has allocated. And I have to point out, too, that there were three really important economic pressures that converged this week. One was the $600 additional unemployment checks, federal unemployment checks stopped for people who were laid off because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Number two is that August rent came due on Saturday for a lot of people who are seeing their unemployment check fall. And three, Mayor Jenny Durkin vetoed the Seattle City Council's COVID-19 relief bill, which would have provided relief for people who are seeing their rent come due and seeing their unemployment checks cut. Durkin vetoed the bill in full and sent it back to the city council. Now, the city council had passed that bill unanimously on July 20th, and it would spend $85.7 million of the city's reserve funds for the following: $32.5 million for rental assistance and homeless shelters, $18.1 million for grocery vouchers for immigrants and refugees who don't qualify for unemployment or other federal assistance, $14.5 million for small business assistance, especially for businesses that couldn't get assistance from the state or from federal governments. Either they didn't qualify or there wasn't money left over for them. $13.5 million.
And the small business loan program, the federal one, that expires today also.
Yes, and the COVID-19 relief bill includes $13.5 million for grocery vouchers for other folks who don't qualify for unemployment, and that's often self-employed people and contractors. $3.6 million for child care assistance, $2.3 million for affordable housing providers to help them get personal protection in place in the face of COVID-19, and $1.1 million for mortgage counseling and foreclosure prevention. Now, these funds were supposed to go to existing programs already funded by city government. So the money is meant to keep those programs running in the face of increased demand and to expand them to serve more people. For example, one rental program that's currently run by King County received requests for aid from 6,800 applicants in April, but was only able to help less than half of those folks. And our city programs are equally stressed and out of money. But Mayor Durkin cited two main reasons for her veto. One is that the city should save that money for the 2021 budget next year. In other words, make her job easier in drafting the 2021 budget. And, of course, she's also saying she thinks the economy is going to be worse in 2021 than it is now. Certainly by vetoing this bill, she's making it worse. And then her second reason is the new jumpstart tax, which will replenish the city's reserve accounts, may be halted by a lawsuit. But this ignores the fact that Teresa Mosqueda, who very carefully drafted the jumpstart tax and the COVID-19 relief bills, she sought extensive input from the city's legal department and from business leaders in Seattle in crafting those two bills, which is, you know, why it's going to collect less than half the amount that Shama Sawant's original Amazon tax bill would collect. But it also means, too, that a legal challenge is much less likely of the jumpstart tax. So by vetoing this bill, Mayor Durkan is once again showing, you know, her Republican leanings and ignoring good fiscal policy in the face of an unprecedented economic emergency. Research shows that government can help put the brakes on an economic downturn and alleviate long-term suffering by spending money at the start of a crisis and not waiting. The longer a government waits, or in Durkan's case, imposes fiscal austerity, the worse the downturn becomes and the deeper the hole that people and businesses have to climb out of later on. It makes the recovery last a lot longer. Government austerity budgets just don't work, and in fact, they make things a lot worse. So,
yep.
So the vote for the city council to vote to overturn Durkan's veto on the COVID-19 relief bill, I think, is set for this coming Wednesday, this coming week. So we can expect that to probably be also a unanimous vote. The question then is, will Durkan actually spend those funds once the city council tells her, yes, they really do want her to do it?
Wow. Yeah, that was just mind blowing for me, seeing her choose the veto.
Yeah, she didn't sign the jumpstart tax bill, but that one was passed unanimously. She just returned it to the city council and let it become law. And I thought she would do the same with the COVID-19 relief bill, but nope, she vetoed it. So that tells you where she stands.
Well, it's going to make for a pretty interesting re-election campaign.
I think it is. Yes, I think it is. We just need to get some good progressive candidates in there.
Yep. And now is the time anybody who can be recruited to do that, to start thinking about how they're going to run. Because Durkan will have a lot of popular opposition, but she will also have a ton of corporate money. And that's a concern.
Yeah, she'll have a lot of consultants behind her helping her run a remote campaign, which is going to be tough this next year with COVID-19 restrictions in place. So anyone who's thinking of challenging her needs to also consider that as well.
Yeah.
All right. On to
you mean we won't have a vaccine by Election Day this year?
We may, but I'm not confident that we'll have the systems in place to distribute and manufacture enough vaccine for a population of, what are we, 350 million people in the United States now? That's a
big... not to mention the rest of the world. And, you know, the idea that we will have a vaccine that has been proven to be both safe and effective and can be manufactured to scale, I don't think all those things can be in place within the next 3 months. It's not going to happen.
No, I don't think it will happen that quickly. A lot of folks are saying 18 months, which would take us through the end of next year. So, and I'm kind of leaning in that direction, thinking that we can expect the status quo for a while yet.
Yeah, I think an optimistic timeline is next spring. That's the most optimistic.
Yeah.
And anything faster than that, and as with our commander in chief, it means they're lying.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to national and talk about the continued dismembering of the U.S. Postal Service.
Oh yeah. You want to tackle this, Maria?
Sure. The Republicans have been delaying a new relief bill in Congress. We'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the elements of that relief bill is $25 billion that the Democrats have proposed in aid for the U.S. Postal Service, which has been in financial trouble for years, and is expected to play a key role in collecting and delivering mail-in ballots in November's election. Now, stymied in a long-held Republican policy to privatize the post office, Trump has instead overseen cost-cutting measures that have been crippling the Postal Service's ability recently to deliver just the regular mail on time. Trump, first off, appointed one of his major donors as Postmaster General. That person is Louis DeJoy. He's president of LDJ Global Strategies, a real estate and private equity management company. DeJoy, who has donated $1.5 million to Donald Trump's campaign, is the first non-employee of the U.S. Postal Service to be named Postmaster General in at least the last couple of decades. In addition, DeJoy and his spouse have between $30 million and $75 million in investments in companies that compete directly with the Postal Service. DeJoy has implemented cost-cutting measures at the U.S. Postal Service that include things like refusing to pay overtime to postal employees to ensure that mail is delivered the same day it's loaded on their truck, shutting down sorting machines early in the day at postal facilities so that mail and packages now sit for days at Postal Service warehouses before they move on to local post offices for delivery. And some post offices have cut back on hours to save costs, making it harder to both mail out packages and receive mail in post office boxes or that require pickup at post offices. He's been requiring letter carriers to leave mail behind, excuse me, if they have to make more than one trip back to the post office or if they feel they need to work extra hours to deliver all the mail for the day. He's told them don't work those extra hours. And finally, on Friday, he quote unquote reorganized top management at the post office to purge longtime veteran U.S. postal employees from top positions and decision making power. Now, as a result, the U.S. Postal Service can no longer guarantee delivery dates for package deliveries, even for express mail. Letter carriers are doing a lot more manual sorting, too, because sorting machines are shut down early in the day, and that slows down the entire process. That means bins of mail are sitting around for days without being delivered, and the backlog is getting worse. And I want to point out that only 5 states are currently set up to do vote-by-mail only, and that's Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Utah, and Washington. Other states are gearing up to do vote by mail because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but they've got a pretty steep hill to climb between now and November. But the tens of millions of ballots that will have to be delivered to voters and collected afterwards could lead to major breakdowns in mail delivery and in the election process.
And that's the immediate point. I mean, you know, more broadly, the Trump project has been to dismantle the federal government, and he's doing a good job of that. But the immediate point is to make it harder for people to vote by mail during a pandemic, because they're trying to suppress the turnout, because they believe that a lower turnout means an advantage for Trump. It's one of the many ways that he's trying to game the system and using the power of the presidency and the power of being the head of the executive branch to be able to do that. And it's a very alarming development, because it's something that has long-term impacts for a very immediate issue for Trump. But.
And, you know, 34 states require completed mail-in ballots to be received by Election Day, not postmarked, received by Election Day. Others allow ballots to be received later as long as they're postmarked by Election Day. But the U.S. Postal Service often delivers ballots without a postmark on them. They often deliver mail in general without a postmark on it. In some states, ballots without a postmark on them are discarded and not counted at all. Any ballot that is received late is not counted in any state that I know of. So this is a serious issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, too, that while Donald Trump keeps tweeting that voting by mail is corrupt and is going to lead to a rigged election, he himself has voted by mail-in ballot in recent elections. And so has Attorney General William Barr, who has also criticized vote by mail. And other members of the Trump administration have also used vote by mail quite extensively, including Vice President Mike Pence, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, Trump's campaign manager Brad Parscale, White House counselor Kellyanne Conway, several cabinet members. The Republican National Committee chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, has also used vote by mail, and members of Trump's family, including First Lady Melania Trump and his daughter Ivanka, have all used vote by mail.
By the way, Brad Parscale is no longer campaign manager. He was replaced a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Oh, you know, they cycle in and out so often, I hardly know who's his current acting whatever.
Yeah.
And that's an issue in itself. We could spend a whole hour talking about.
Yep, we could. But let's not.
Yeah, let's not. Let's move on.
All right. Also on the chopping block, potentially chopping block this week, was the National Rifle Association is being dismembered by the New York Attorney General. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. Do you want to talk about that, Joff?
Sure. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, filed suit this week to dissolve the charter of the National Rifle Association, which was chartered in New York State in the 19th century. And the 150-page brief that she filed in support of that was really pretty stunning in terms of the level of corruption and self-dealing. It detailed over the past 3 years some $62 million worth of member dues, that is, dues by your uncle who has the proud NRA sticker on the back of his pickup. He's sending money in to buy private jet trips to the Bahamas, nice stays in four-star hotels, very high-end wardrobes, etc. And this was just for four top executives at the National Rifle Association. A lot of self-dealing, and all of that is blatantly illegal. There are laws governing what nonprofits can and can't spend member dues on, and this was plainly illegal. And James is making the case that the corruption was so extensive and so pervasive that there was a culture of it, and it was taken for granted within the culture of the NRA, that the NRA itself needs to be dissolved. The NRA, of course, is strenuously opposed to this. And you had Trump tweeting somewhat disingenuously, the NRA should leave New York. It should just dissolve itself and then reconstitute itself in Texas. Well, it can't do that under the terms of this kind of a lawsuit. And Trump himself knows that, or he would have dissolved the Trump Foundation and reconstituted it in a different state instead of having it permanently banned, and he and most of his family members permanently banned from serving on the boards of nonprofits when the New York Attorney General, the previous New York Attorney General, sued the Trump Foundation a couple of years ago. For some of the same issues around, taking money that was meant to be, redistributed for, nonprofit good works, et cetera, and using it for personal gain instead. So Trump knows this, the NRA knows this, and some important context here, the NRA has also been under investigation by Congress for its role in the 2016 election, because they spent some $50 million in the election, all of it on Republican congressional candidates or on the presidential race. Some $30 million of it went to the Trump campaign, which was by far a record for them for spending and was hugely important to the Trump campaign in terms of its financing. And there's a fair amount of evidence that money was not NRA money. It was funneled from Russian oligarchs. This was where the whole Maria Butina case came in, and that particular link between Russia and the NRA. So there's that question of corruption in the political process as well. So not a lot of people are shedding tears for the NRA right now.
All right. Moving on, the stimulus negotiations fell apart this week.
Yeah, Maria, do you want to tackle that, or shall I?
I can kind of give the roundup a little bit. The Republicans were fighting with the Democrats, as usual, with the White House not acting in a supervisory role at all. kind of stirring the pot, so to speak. The Republicans are proposing a $1 trillion bill. The Democrats have previously proposed a $3.4 trillion bill and then said that they would lower it to $2.4 trillion, but are saying that the Republicans are not negotiating with them at all. And the main sticking points are include aid to state and local governments. The Republicans want to provide zero aid to state and local governments. Now, I want to point out here in Seattle that Jenny Durkin keeps telling the Seattle City Council don't spend COVID relief money out of reserves because she's waiting for the federal government to pass a bill that will give money to state and local governments. Well, the Republicans are adamant that they're not going to do that. Other issues that they can't agree on at the federal level is education funding for remote learning for school districts, which the Democrats want to supply, but the Republicans don't. Relief for the U.S. Postal Service for mail-in voting in November. I just talked about that. The Democrats want to do that. The Republicans say no. And full renewal of the $600 enhanced unemployment benefits. The Democrats want to extend that. Even Donald Trump wants to extend that now. But the Republicans in Congress say no. They want to either cut that completely or cut it down to $200. Now, Trump is also, he keeps saying over and over again that if Congress doesn't agree on a bill, he's just going to take executive action. And his top idea is to suspend, not permanently cut, payroll taxes, which will do absolutely zero for unemployed people. Right.
But it will help his rich friends.
Right. And it puts the burden to eventually pay those payroll taxes on workers next year in 2021, because he's not cutting payroll taxes. He would just be extending the date by which they need to be paid. So they wouldn't be withheld this year. They'd be doubly withheld next year. And it's really, I think, an idea to try to get himself reelected. It's not good fiscal policy, and it would be extremely burdensome on people, on workers next year, to have to double pay their payroll taxes. So
pretty much everything that he's doing is to get reelected at this point. I mean, there's no policy that's coming out of the White House right now that is not intended to boost his reelection chances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's essentially what's going on. And Congress is supposed to be taking their summer vacation starting next week. We'll see if that actually happens, if they decide to leave Washington, D.C., without passing any renewal of
Pelosi has said the House is going nowhere until something is passed, but the Senate is likely to leave town. I think.
The Senate, nothing can really happen. So
yeah, and Mitch McConnell has really been missing in action these past few days in the negotiations. They've been between the House leaders and the White House. McConnell's really at fault for a lot of this, because the House passed its package in May. That was 3 months ago. Plenty of time for them to negotiate with the Senate. That bill sat on McConnell's desk while he did nothing for 2 months, and then he adjourned the Senate for the first half of July as well, thinking that would put pressure on the Democrats to agree to a deal. Well, that didn't work out, and, you know, one of McConnell's other major negotiating points, he wants to indemnify corporations for any damages that might result from employees that get COVID-19 from unsafe working conditions. He's looking to essentially void OSHA, all sorts of different worker safety laws and public health standards.
Even companies' professional liability insurance. So essentially, he's saying,
all the way through 2024, which is to say, all the way through a potential Joe Biden term in the White House.
So, yeah, that's unacceptable.
Of course, it is. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right, events.
Oh yeah, we do have events coming up.
Well, an event today.
From
6 p.m. to 8 p.m. is the Solidarity Walk for Farm Workers' Rights. That's at Westlake Park downtown from 6 to 8 p.m.
Tomorrow, The Seattle Police Officers Guild has invited the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer and all sorts of other unsavory elements to stop the defunding of SPD. That will be a rally at Seattle City Hall Plaza, and I'm sure there will be a counter-protest. That's at noon. So go if you want to yell at the neo-Nazis, and otherwise just stay far away. Then on Monday, as we mentioned, it's an all-day session for City Hall. The morning at 9 o'clock is voting the various amendments for SPD's budget out of committee. And then that final full council vote will be the afternoon 2 o'clock session. So that'll all be by Zoom. You can sign up early. Get there about an hour early, I would say, to sign up and then join in.